His shrub-like beard was in need of a trim. Gregarious by nature, Hall proved to be a skillful raconteur with the caustic Kiwi wit, launching into a long story involving a French tourist, a Buddhist monk, and a particularly shaggy yak. Hall delivered the punchline with an impish squint, paused a beat for effect, then threw his head back in a booming, contagious laugh, unable to contain his delight in his own yarn. I liked him immediately. Hall was born into a working-class Catholic family in Christchurch, New Zealand, the youngest of 9 children. Although he had a quick, scientific mind, at the age of 15 he dropped out of school after butting heads with an especially autocratic teacher, and in 1976 he went to work for Alp Sports, a local manufacturer of climbing equipment. He started out doing odd jobs, working a sewing machine, things like that, remembers Bill Atkinson, now an accomplished climber and guide, who also worked at Alp Sports at the time. But because of Rob's impressive organizational skills, which were apparent even when he was 16 and 17, he was soon running the entire production side of the company. Hall had for some years been an avid hill walker. About the same time he went to work for Alp Sports, he took up rock and ice climbing as well. He was a fast learner, says Atkinson, who became Hall's most frequent climbing partner, with the ability to soak up skills and attitudes from anybody. In 1980, when Hall was 19, he joined an expedition that climbed the demanding north ridge of Amada Blam, a 22,294-foot peak of incomparable beauty 15 miles south of Everest. During that trip, Hall's first to the Himalaya, he made a side excursion to Everest Base Camp and resolved that one day he would climb the world's highest mountain. It required 10 years and 3 attempts, but in May 1990, Hall finally reached the summit of Everest as the leader of an expedition that included Peter Hillary, the son of Sir Edmund. On the summit, Hall and Hillary made a radio transmission that was broadcast live throughout New Zealand and at 29,028 feet received congratulations from Prime Minister Geoffrey Palmer. By this time, Hall was a full-time professional climber. Like most of his peers, he sought funding from corporate sponsors to pay for his expensive Himalayan expeditions. And he was savvy enough to understand that the more attention he got from the news media, the easier it would be to coax corporations to open their checkbooks. As it happened, he proved to be extremely adept at getting his name into print and his mug on the telly. Yeah, Atkinson allows, Rob always did have a bit of flair for publicity. In 1988, a guide from Auckland named Gary Ball became Hall's primary climbing partner and closest friend. Ball reached the summit of Everest with Hall in 1990, and soon after returning to New Zealand, they concocted a scheme to climb the highest summits on each of the 7 continents, a la Dick Bass, but to raise the bar by doing all 7 of them in 7 months. Note, it took Bass 4 years to ascend the 7 summits. End of note. With Everest, the most difficult of the septet already taken care of, Hall and Ball wangled backing from a big electrical utility, Power Build, and were on their way. On December 12, 1990, mere hours before their 7-month deadline was due to expire, they reached the crest of the 7th summit, the Vinson Massif, at 16,067 feet, the highest point in Antarctica, to considerable fanfare throughout their homeland. Despite their success, Hall and Ball were concerned about their long-term prospects in the professional climbing racket. To continue receiving sponsorship from companies, explains Atkinson, a climber has to keep upping the ante. The next climb has to be harder and more spectacular than the last. It becomes an ever-tightening spiral. Eventually, you're not up to the challenge anymore. Rob and Gary understood that sooner or later, they wouldn't be up to performing at the cutting edge, or they'd have an unlucky accident and get killed. So they decided to switch direction and get into high-altitude guiding. When you're guiding, you don't get to do the climbs you necessarily most want to do. The challenge comes from getting clients up and down, which is a different sort of satisfaction. But it's a more sustainable career than endlessly chasing after sponsorships. There's a limitless supply of clients out there if you offer them a good product. During the 7 summits in 7 months extravaganza, Hall and Ball formulated a plan to go into business together, guiding clients up the 7 summits. Convinced that an untapped market of dreamers existed with ample cash but insufficient experience to climb the world's great mountains on their own, Hall and Ball launched an enterprise they christened Adventure Consultants. Almost immediately, they racked up an impressive record. In May 1992, Hall and Ball led 6 clients to the summit of Everest. A year later, they guided another group of 7 to the top on an afternoon when 40 people reached the summit in a single day. They came home from that expedition, however, to unanticipated public criticism from Sir Edmund Hillary, who decried Hall's role in the growing commercialization of Everest. The crowds of novices being escorted to the top for a fee, huffed Sir Edmund, were engendering disrespect for the mountain. In New Zealand, Hillary is one of the most honored figures in the nation. His craggy visage even stares out from the face of the $5 bill. It saddened and embarrassed Hall to be publicly castigated by this demigod, this ur-climber, who had been one of his childhood heroes. Hillary is regarded as a living national treasure here in New Zealand, says Atkinson. What he says carries a lot of weight, and it must have really hurt to be criticized by him. Rob wanted to make a public statement to defend himself, but he realized that going up against such a venerated figure in the media was a no-win situation. Then, 5 months after the Hillary brouhaha flared, Hall was rocked by an even greater blow. In October 1993, Gary Ball died of cerebral edema, swelling of the brain brought on by high altitude, during an attempt on 26,795-foot Dolly Geary, the world's 6th tallest mountain. Ball drew his last labored breaths in Hall's arms, lying comatose in a small tent high on the peak. The next day, Hall buried his friend in a crevasse. In a New Zealand television interview following the expedition, Hall somberly described how he took their favorite climbing rope and lowered Ball's body into the depths of the glacier. A climbing rope is designed to sort of attach you together, and you never let go of it, he said, and I had to let it just sort of slip through me hands. Rob was devastated when Gary died, says Helen Wilton, who worked as Hall's base camp manager on Everest in 1993, 95, and 96. But he dealt with it very quietly. That was Rob's way, to get on with things. Hall resolved to carry on alone with Adventure Consultants. In his systematic fashion, he continued to refine the company's infrastructure and services, and continued to be extraordinarily successful at escorting amateur climbers to the summits of big, remote mountains. Between 1990 and 1995, Hall was responsible for putting 39 climbers on the summit of Everest, 3 more ascents than had been made in the first 20 years after Sir Edmund Hillary's inaugural climb. With justification, Hall advertised that Adventure Consultants was the world leader in Everest climbing, with more ascents than any other organization. The brochure he sent to prospective clients declared, "So, you have a thirst for adventure. Perhaps you dream of visiting 7 continents or standing on top of a tall mountain. Most of us never dare act on our dreams, and scarcely venture to share them or admit to great inner yearnings. Adventure Consultants specializes in organizing and guiding mountain climbing adventures. Skilled in the practicalities of developing dreams into reality, we work with you to reach your goal. We will not drag you up a mountain. You will have to work hard, but we guarantee to maximize the safety and success of your adventure. For those who dare to face their dreams, the experience offers something special beyond the power of words to describe. We invite you to climb your mountain with us." By 1996, Hall was charging $65,000 a head to guide clients to the top of the world. By any measure, this is a lot of money. It equals the mortgage on my Seattle home. And the quoted price did not include airfare to Nepal or personal equipment. No company's fee was higher. Indeed, some of his competitors charged a third as much. But thanks to Hall's phenomenal success rate, he had no trouble filling the roster for this, his 8th expedition to Everest. If you were hell-bent on climbing the peak and could somehow come up with the dough, Adventure Consultants was the obvious choice. If you were hell-bent on climbing the peak and could somehow come up with the dough, Adventure Consultants was the obvious choice. On the morning of March 31st, 2 days after arriving in Kathmandu, the assembled members of the 1996 Adventure Consultants Everest Expedition walked across the tarmac of Tribhuvan International Airport and climbed aboard a Russian-built Mi-17 helicopter operated by Asian Airlines. A dented relic of the Afghan War, it was as big as a school bus, seated 26 passengers, and looked like it had been riveted together in somebody's backyard. The flight engineer latched the door and handed out wads of cotton to stuff in our ears, and the behemoth chopper lumbered into the air with a head-splitting roar. The floor was piled high with duffels, backpacks, and cardboard boxes. Jammed into jump seats around the perimeter of the aircraft was the human cargo, facing inward, knees wedged against chests. The deafening whine of the turbines made conversation out of the question. It wasn't a comfortable ride, but nobody complained. In 1963, Tom Hornbein's expedition began the long trek to Everest from Banepa, a dozen miles outside Kathmandu, and spent 31 days on the trail before arriving at base camp. Like most modern Everesters, we'd elected to leapfrog over the majority of those steep, dusty miles. The chopper was supposed to set us down in the distant village of Lukla, 9,200 feet up in the Himalaya. Assuming we didn't crash en route, the flight would trim some 3 weeks from the span of Hornbein's trek. Glancing around the helicopter's capacious interior, I tried to fix the names of my teammates in my memory. In addition to guides Rob Hall and Andy Harris, there was Helen Wilton, a 39-year-old mother of four, who was returning for her third season as base camp manager. Caroline McKenzie, an accomplished climber and physician in her late 20s, was the expedition doctor and, like Helen, would be going no higher than base camp. Lou Kosicki, the gentlemanly lawyer I'd met at the airport, had climbed 6 of the 7 summits, as had Yasko Namba, 47, a taciturn personnel director who worked at the Tokyo branch of Federal Express. Beck Weathers, 49, was a garrulous pathologist from Dallas. Stuart Hutchison, 34, attired in a Ren and Stimpy t-shirt, was a cerebral, somewhat wonkish Canadian cardiologist on leave from a research fellowship. John Taskey, at 56, the oldest member of our group, was an anesthesiologist from Brisbane, who'd taken up climbing after retiring from the Australian Army. Frank Fishbeck, 53, a dapper, genteel publisher from Hong Kong, had attempted Everest 3 times with one of Hall's competitors. In 1994, he'd gotten all the way to the South Summit, just 330 vertical feet below the top. Doug Hansen, 46, was an American postal worker who'd gone to Everest with Hall in 1995 and, like Fishbeck, had reached the South Summit before turning back. I wasn't sure what to make of my fellow clients. In outlook and experience, they were nothing like the hardcore climbers with whom I usually went into the mountains, but they seemed like nice, decent folks, and there wasn't a certifiable asshole in the entire group, at least not one who was showing his true colors at this early stage of the proceedings. Nevertheless, I didn't have much in common with any of my teammates except Doug, a wiry, hard-partying man with a prematurely weathered face that brought to mind an old football. He'd been a postal worker for more than 27 years. He told me that he'd paid for the trip by working the night shift and doing construction jobs by day. Because I'd earned my living as a carpenter for 8 years before becoming a writer, and because the tax bracket we shared set us conspicuously apart from the other clients, I already felt comfortable around Doug in a way that I didn't with the others. For the most part, I attributed my growing unease to the fact that I'd never climbed as a member of such a large group, a group of complete strangers, no less. Aside from one Alaska trip I'd done 21 years earlier, all my previous expeditions had been undertaken with one or two trusted friends, or alone. In climbing, having confidence in your partners is no small concern. One climber's actions can affect the welfare of the entire team. The consequences of a poorly tied knot, a stumble, a dislodged rock, or some other careless deed are as likely to be felt by the perpetrator's colleagues as the perpetrator. Hence, it's not surprising that climbers are typically wary of joining forces with those whose bona fides are unknown to them. But trust in one's partners is a luxury denied those who sign on as clients on a guided ascent. One must put one's faith in the guide instead. As the helicopter droned toward Lukla, I suspected that each of my teammates hoped as fervently as I that Hall had been careful to weed out clients of dubious ability and would have the means to protect each of us from one another's shortcomings. Chapter 4. Phoc Ding, March 31st, 1996. 9,186 feet. For those who didn't dally, our daily treks ended early in the afternoon, but rarely before the heat and aching feet forced us to ask each passing Sherpa, "How much farther to camp?" The reply, we soon were to discover, was invariable. "Only 2 mile more, Sahib." Evenings were peaceful, smoke settling in the quiet air to soften the dusk, lights twinkling on the ridge we would camp on tomorrow, clouds dimming the outline of our pass for the day after. Growing excitement lured my thoughts again and again to the west ridge. There was loneliness, too, as the sun set, but only rarely now did doubts return. Then I felt sinkingly as if my whole life lay behind me. Once on the mountain, I knew, or trusted, that this would give way to total absorption with the task at hand. But at times, I wondered if I had not come a long way only to find that what I really sought was something I had left behind. Thomas F. Hornbein, Everest, the West Ridge. From Lukla, the way to Everest led north through the crepuscular gorge of the Dude Khosi, an icy, boulder-choked river that churned with glacial runoff. We spent the first night of our trek in the hamlet of Phoc Ding, a collection of a half-dozen homes and lodges crowded onto a shelf of level ground on a slope above the river. The air took on a wintry sting as night fell, and in the morning, as I headed up the trail, a glaze of frost sparkled from the rhododendron leaves. But the Everest region lies at 28 degrees north latitude, just beyond the tropics, and as soon as the sun rose high enough to penetrate the depths of the canyon, the temperature soared. By noon, after we'd crossed a wobbly footbridge suspended high over the river, the fourth river crossing of the day, rivulets of sweat were dripping off my chin, and I peeled down to shorts and a t-shirt. Beyond the bridge, the dirt path abandoned the banks of the Dude Khosi and zigzagged up the steep canyon wall, ascending through aromatic stands of pine. The spectacularly fluted ice pinnacles of Tamserku and Kusim Kangru pierced the sky more than 2 vertical miles above. It was magnificent country, as topographically imposing as any landscape on Earth. But it wasn't wilderness, and hadn't been for hundreds of years. Every scrap of arable land had been terraced and planted with barley, bitter buckwheat, or potatoes. Strings of prayer flags were strung across the hillsides, and ancient Buddhist chortens and walls of exquisitely carved mani stones stood sentinel over even the highest passes. Note: a chorten is a religious monument usually made of rock and often containing sacred relics. It is also called a stupa. Mani stones are small, flat rocks that have been meticulously carved with Sanskrit symbols denoting the Tibetan Buddhist invocation Om Mani Padme Hum, and are piled along the middle of trails to form long, low mani walls. Buddhist protocol dictates that travelers always pass mani walls on the left. End of note. As I made my way up from the river, the trail was clogged with trekkers, yak trains, red-robed monks, and barefoot Sherpas straining beneath back-wrenching loads of firewood and kerosene and soda pop. Note: technically speaking, the great majority of the yaks one sees in the Himalaya are actually dzogchen, male crossbreeds of yaks and cattle, or tsom, female crossbreeds. Additionally, female yaks, when purebred, are correctly termed naks. Most Westerners, however, have a hard time telling any of these shaggy beasts apart and refer to all of them as yaks. End of note. 90 minutes above the river, I crested a broad ridge, past a matrix of rock-walled yak corrals, and abruptly found myself in downtown Namche Bazaar, the social and commercial hub of Sherpa society. Situated 11,300 feet above sea level, Namche occupies a huge tilting bowl proportioned like a giant satellite television dish midway up a precipitous mountainside. More than 100 buildings nestled dramatically on the rocky slope, linked by a maze of narrow paths and catwalks. Near the lower edge of town, I located the Khumbu Lodge, pushed aside the blanket that functioned as a front door, and found my teammates drinking lemon tea around a table in the corner. When I approached, Rob Hall introduced me to Mike Groom, the expedition's third guide. A 33-year-old Australian with carrot-colored hair and the lean build of a marathon runner, Groom was a Brisbane plumber who worked as a guide only occasionally. In 1987, forced to spend a night in the open while descending from the 28,169-foot summit of Kanchenjunga, he froze his feet and had to have all his toes amputated. This setback had not put a damper on his Himalayan career, however. He'd gone on to climb K2, Lhotse, Cho Oyu, Ama Dablam, and in 1993, Everest without supplementary oxygen. An exceedingly calm, circumspect man, Groom was pleasant company, but seldom spoke unless spoken to, and replied to questions tersely, in a barely audible voice. Dinner conversation was dominated by the three clients who were doctors, Stewart, John, and especially Beck, a pattern that would be repeated for much of the expedition. Fortunately, both John and Beck were wickedly funny and had the group in stitches. Beck, however, was in the habit of turning his monologues into scathing, Limbaugh-esque rants against bedwetting liberals, and at one point that evening, I made the mistake of disagreeing with him. In response to one of his comments, I suggested that raising the minimum wage seemed like a wise and necessary policy. Well-informed and a very skilled debater, Beck made hash out of my fumbling avowal, and I lacked the wherewithal to rebut him. All I could do was sit on my hands, tongue-tied and steaming. As he continued to hold forth in his swampy East Texas drawl about the numerous follies of the welfare state, I got up and left the table to avoid humiliating myself further. When I returned to the dining room, I approached the proprietress to ask for a beer. A small, graceful Sherpani, she was in the midst of taking an order from a group of American trekkers. "We hungry," a ruddy-cheeked man announced to her in overly loud pidgin, miming the act of eating. "Want eat potatoes. Yak burger. Coca-Cola. You have?" "Would you like to see the menu?" the Sherpani replied in clear, sparkling English that carried a hint of a Canadian accent. "Our selection is actually quite large, and I believe there is still some freshly baked apple pie available, if that interests you, for dessert." The American trekker, unable to comprehend that this brown-skinned woman of the hills was addressing him in perfectly enunciated King's English, continued to employ his comical pigeon argot. "Menu. Good, good. Yes, yes. We like see menu." Sherpas remain an enigma to most foreigners, who tend to regard them through a romantic scrim. People unfamiliar with the demography of the Himalaya often assume that all Nepalese are Sherpas, when in fact there are no more than 20,000 Sherpas in all of Nepal, a nation the size of North Carolina that has some 20 million residents and more than 50 distinct ethnic groups. Sherpas are mountain people, devoutly Buddhist, whose forebears migrated south from Tibet 4 or 5 centuries ago. There are Sherpa villages scattered throughout the Himalaya of eastern Nepal, and sizable Sherpa communities can be found in Sikkim and Darjeeling, India. But the heart of Sherpa country is the Khumbu, a handful of valleys draining the southern slopes of Mount Everest, a small, astonishingly rugged region completely devoid of roads, cars, or wheeled vehicles of any kind. Farming is difficult in the high, cold, steep-walled valleys, so traditional Sherpa economy revolved around trading between Tibet and India and herding yaks. Then in 1921, the British embarked on their first expedition to Everest, and their decision to engage Sherpas as helpers sparked a transformation of Sherpa culture. Because the Kingdom of Nepal kept its borders closed until 1949, the initial Everest reconnaissance and the next 8 expeditions to follow were forced to approach the mountain from the north, through Tibet, and never passed anywhere near the Khumbu. But those first 9 expeditions embarked for Tibet from Darjeeling, where many Sherpas had emigrated, and where they had developed a reputation among the resident colonialists for being hard-working, affable, and intelligent. Additionally, because most Sherpas had lived for generations in villages situated between 9,000 and 14,000 feet, they were physiologically adapted to the rigors of high altitude. Upon the recommendation of A. M. Kellis, a Scottish physician who'd climbed and traveled extensively with Sherpas, the 1921 Everest expedition hired a large corps of them as load-bearers and camp helpers, a practice that's been followed by all but a smattering of expeditions in the 75 years since. For better and worse, over the past 2 decades, the economy and culture of the Khumbu has become increasingly and irrevocably tied to the seasonal influx of trekkers and climbers, some 15,000 of whom visit the region annually. Sherpas who learn technical climbing skills and work high on the peaks, especially those who have summited Everest, enjoy great esteem in their communities. Those who become climbing stars, alas, also stand a fair chance of losing their lives. Ever since 1922, when 7 Sherpas were killed in an avalanche during the 2nd British expedition, a disproportionate number of Sherpas have died on Everest, 53 all told. Indeed, they account for more than a third of all Everest fatalities. Despite the hazards, there is stiff competition among Sherpas for the 12 to 18 staff positions on the typical Everest expedition. The most sought-after jobs are the half-dozen openings for skilled climbing Sherpas, who can expect to earn $1,400 to $2,500 for 2 months of hazardous work. Attractive pay in a nation mired in grinding poverty and with an annual per capita income of around $160. To handle the growing traffic from Western climbers and trekkers, new lodges and tea houses are springing up across the Khumbu region. But the new construction is especially evident in Namche Bazaar. On the trail to Namche, I passed countless porters headed up from the lowland forests, carrying freshly cut wood beams that weighed in excess of 100 pounds, crushing physical toil, for which they were paid about $3 a day. Long-time visitors to the Khumbu are saddened by the boom in tourism and the change it has wrought on what early Western climbers regarded as an earthly paradise, a real-life Shangri-La. Entire valleys have been denuded of trees to meet the increased demand for firewood. Teens hanging out in Namche Karom parlors are more likely to be wearing jeans and Chicago Bulls t-shirts than quaint traditional robes. Families are apt to spend their evenings huddled around video players viewing the latest Schwarzenegger opus. The transformation of the Khumbu culture is certainly not all for the best, but I didn't hear many Sherpas bemoaning the changes. Hard currency from trekkers and climbers, as well as grants from international relief organizations supported by trekkers and climbers, have funded schools and medical clinics, reduced infant mortality, built footbridges, and brought hydroelectric power to Namche and other villages. It seems more than a little patronizing for Westerners to lament the loss of the good old days when life in the Khumbu was so much simpler and more picturesque. Most of the people who live in this rugged country seem to have no desire to be severed from the modern world or the untidy flow of human progress. The last thing Sherpas want is to be preserved as specimens in an anthropological museum. A strong walker, pre-acclimatized to the altitude, could cover the distance from the Lukla airstrip to Everest Base Camp in 2 or 3 long days. Because most of us had just arrived from sea level, however, Hall was careful to keep us to a more indolent pace that gave our bodies time to adapt to the increasingly thin air. Seldom did we walk more than 3 or 4 hours on any given day. On several days, when Hall's itinerary called for additional acclimatization, we walked nowhere at all. On April 3rd, after an acclimatization day in Namche, we resumed the trek toward base camp. 20 minutes beyond the village, I rounded a bend and arrived at a breathtaking overlook. 2,000 feet below slicing a deep crease through the surrounding bedrock, the dude Kosi appeared as a crooked strand of silver, glinting from the shadows. 10,000 feet above, the huge backlit spike of Amadablam hovered over the head of the valley like an apparition. And 7,000 feet higher still, dwarfing Amadablam, was the icy thrust of Everest itself, all but hidden behind Nupsi. As always seemed to be the case, a horizontal plume of condensation streamed from the summit like frozen smoke, betraying the violence of the jet stream winds. I stared at the peak for perhaps 30 minutes, trying to apprehend what it would be like to be standing on that gale-swept vertex. Although I'd ascended hundreds of mountains, Everest was so different from anything I'd previously climbed that my powers of imagination were insufficient for the task. The summit looked so cold, so high, so impossibly far away. I felt as though I might as well be on an expedition to the moon. As I turned away to continue walking up the trail, my emotions oscillated between nervous anticipation and a nearly overwhelming sense of dread. Late that afternoon, I arrived in Tengboche, the largest, most important Buddhist monastery in the Khumbu. Chongba Sherpa, a wry, thoughtful man who had joined our expedition as base camp cook, offered to arrange a meeting with the Rinpoche, the head lama of all Nepal, Chongba explained, a very holy man. Just yesterday, he has finished a long period of silent meditation. For the past 3 months, he has not spoken. We will be his first visitors. This is most auspicious. Doug, Lou, and I each gave Chongba 100 rupees, approximately $2, to buy ceremonial katas, white silk scarves to be presented to the Rinpoche, and then we removed our shoes and Chongba led us to a small, drafty chamber behind the main temple. Seated cross-legged on a brocade pillow, wrapped in burgundy robes, was a short, rotund man with a shiny pate. He looked very old and very tired. Chongba bowed reverently, spoke briefly to him in the Sherpa tongue, and indicated for us to come forward. The Rinpoche then blessed each of us in turn, placing the katas we had purchased around our necks as he did so. Afterward, he smiled beatifically and offered us tea. "This kata you should wear to the top of Everest," Chongba instructed me in a solemn voice. "It will please God and keep you from harm." Note: although the Tibetan name for the peak is Jomolungma and the Nepali name is Sagarmatha, most Sherpas seem to refer to the mountain as Everest in daily conversation, even when speaking with other Sherpas. End of note. Unsure how to act in the company of a divine presence, this living reincarnation of an ancient and illustrious lama, I was terrified of unwittingly giving offense or committing some irredeemable faux pas. As I sipped sweet tea and fidgeted, His Holiness rooted around in an adjacent cabinet, brought out a large, ornately decorated book, and handed it to me. I wiped my dirty hands on my pants and opened it nervously. It was a photo album. The Rinpoche, it turned out, had recently traveled to America for the first time, and the book held snapshots from his trip, His Holiness in Washington standing before the Lincoln Memorial and the Air and Space Museum, His Holiness in California on the Santa Monica Pier. Grinning broadly, he excitedly pointed out his two favorite photos in the entire album, His Holiness posing beside Richard Gere, and another shot of him with Steven Seagal. The first 6 days of the trek went by in an ambrosial blur. The trail took us past glades of juniper and dwarf birch, blue pine and rhododendron, thundering waterfalls, enchanting boulder gardens, burbling streams. The Valkyrian skyline bristled with peaks that I'd been reading about since I was a child. Because most of our gear was carried by yaks and human porters, my own backpack held little more than a jacket, a few candy bars, and my camera. Unburdened and unhurried, caught up in the simple joy of walking in exotic country, I fell into a kind of trance, but the euphoria seldom lasted for long. Sooner or later, I'd remember where I was headed, and the shadow Everest cast across my mind would snap me back to attention. We all trekked at our own pace, pausing often for refreshment at trailside tea houses and to chat with passers-by. I frequently found myself traveling in the company of Doug Hansen, the postal worker, and Andy Harris, Rob Hall's laid-back junior guide. Andy, called Harold by Rob and all his Kiwi friends, was a big, sturdy lad, built like an NFL quarterback, with rugged good looks of the sort that earn men roles in cigarette advertisements. During the antipodal winter, he was employed as a much-in-demand helicopter skiing guide. Summers, he worked for scientists conducting geologic research in Antarctica or escorted climbers into New Zealand's southern Alps. As we walked up the trail, Andy spoke longingly of the woman with whom he lived, a physician named Fiona McPherson. As we rested on a rock, he pulled a picture out of his pack to show me. She was tall, blonde, athletic-looking. Andy said he and Fiona were in the midst of building a house together in the hills outside of Queenstown. Waxing ardent about the uncomplicated pleasures of sawing rafters and pounding nails, Andy admitted that when Rob had first offered him this Everest job, he'd been ambivalent about accepting it. It was quite hard to leave Fee in the house, actually. We'd only just gotten the roof on, yeah? But how can you turn down a chance to climb Everest, especially when you have an opportunity to work alongside somebody like Rob Hall? Although Andy had never been to Everest before, he was no stranger to the Himalaya. In 1985, he climbed a difficult 21,927-foot peak called Chobuzi, about 30 miles west of Everest. And in the fall of 1994, he spent 4 months helping Fiona run the medical clinic in Faroche, a gloomy, wind-battered hamlet 14,000 feet above sea level, where we stayed the nights of April 4th and 5th. The clinic was funded by a foundation called the Himalayan Rescue Association, primarily to treat altitude-related illnesses, although it also offered free treatment to the local Sherpas, and to educate trekkers about the insidious hazards of ascending too high too fast. It had been established in 1973 after 4 members of a single Japanese trekking group succumbed to the altitude and died in the vicinity. Prior to the clinic's existence, acute altitude illness killed approximately 1 or 2 out of every 500 trekkers who passed through Faroche. Laura Ziemer, an upbeat American lawyer who, at the time of our visit, was working at the four-room facility with her physician husband, Jim Litch, and another young physician named Larry Silver, emphasized that this alarming death rate hadn't been skewed upward by mountaineering accidents. The victims had been just ordinary trekkers who never ventured beyond the established trails. Now, thanks to the educational seminars and emergency care provided by the clinic's volunteer staff, that mortality rate has been cut to less than 1 death per 30,000 trekkers. Although idealistic Westerners like Ziemer who work at the Faroche Clinic receive no remuneration and must even pay their own travel expenses to and from Nepal, it is a prestigious posting that attracts highly qualified applicants from around the world. Caroline McKenzie, Hall's expedition doctor, had worked at the HRA clinic with Fiona McPherson and Andy in the autumn of 1994. In 1990, the year Hall first summited Everest, the clinic was run by an accomplished, self-confident physician from New Zealand named Jan Arnold. Hall met her as he passed through Faroche on his way to the mountain, and he was immediately smitten. "I asked Jan to go out with me as soon as I got down from Everest," Hall reminisced during our first night in the village. "For our first date, I proposed going to Alaska and climbing Mount McKinley together, and she said yes." They were married 2 years later. In 1993, Arnold climbed to the summit of Everest with Hall. In 1994 and 1995, she traveled to base camp to work as the expedition doctor. Arnold would have returned to the mountain again this year, except that she was 7 months pregnant with their first child. So the job went to Dr. McKenzie. After dinner on Thursday, our first night in Faroche, Laura Ziemer and Jim Litch invited Hall, Harris, and Helen Wilton, our base camp manager, over to the clinic to raise a glass and catch up on gossip. Over the course of the evening, the conversation drifted to the inherent risks of climbing and guiding Everest, and Litch remembers the discussion with chilling clarity. Hall, Harris, and Litch were in complete agreement that sooner or later a major disaster involving a large number of clients was inevitable. But said Litch, who had climbed Everest from Tibet the previous spring. Rob's feeling was that it wouldn't be him. He was just worried about having to save another team's ass, and that when the unavoidable calamity struck, he was sure it would occur on the more dangerous north side of the peak, the Tibetan side. On Saturday, April 6th, a few hours above Ferichay, we arrived at the lower end of the Khumbu Glacier, a 12-mile tongue of ice that flows down from the south flank of Everest and would serve as our highway, I hoped mightily, to the summit. At 16,000 feet now, we'd left behind the last trace of green. 20 stone monuments stood in a somber row along the crest of the glacier's terminal moraine, overlooking the mist-filled valley, memorials to climbers who had died on Everest, most of them Sherpa. From this point forward, our world would be a barren, monochromatic expanse of rock and wind-blown ice, and despite our measured pace, I had begun to feel the effects of the altitude, which left me lightheaded and constantly fighting for breath. The trail here remained buried beneath a head-high winter snowpack in many places. As the snow softened in the afternoon sun, the hoofs of our yaks punched through the frozen crust, and the beasts wallowed to their bellies. The grumbling yak drivers thrashed their animals to force them onward and threatened to turn around. Late in the day, we reached a village called Lobije, and there sought refuge from the wind in a cramped, spectacularly filthy lodge. A collection of low, tumble-down buildings huddled against the elements at the edge of the Khumbu Glacier. Lobije was a grim place, crowded with Sherpas and climbers from a dozen different expeditions, German trekkers, herds of emaciated yaks, all bound for Everest Base Camp, still a day's travel up the valley. The bottleneck, Rob explained, was due to the unusually late and heavy snowpack, which until just yesterday had kept any yaks at all from reaching base camp. The hamlet's half-dozen lodges were completely full. Tents were jammed side by side on the few patches of muddy earth not covered with snow. Scores of rye and tamang porters from the low foothills, dressed in thin rags and flip-flops, they were working as load-bearers for various expeditions, were bivouacked in caves and under boulders on the surrounding slopes. The three or four stone toilets in the village were literally overflowing with excrement. The latrines were so abhorrent that most people, Nepalese and Westerners alike, evacuated their bowels outside, on the open ground, wherever the urge struck. Huge, stinking piles of human feces lay everywhere. It was impossible not to walk in it. The river of snowmelt meandering through the center of the settlement was an open sewer. The main room of the lodge where we stayed was furnished with wooden bunk platforms for some 30 people. I found an unoccupied bunk on the upper level, shook as many fleas and lice as possible from the soiled mattress, and spread out my sleeping bag. Against the near wall was a small iron stove that supplied heat by burning dried yak dung. After sunset, the temperature dropped well below freezing, and porters flocked in from the cruel night to warm themselves around the stove. Because dung burns poorly under the best of circumstances, and especially so in the oxygen-depleted air of 16,200 feet, the lodge filled with dense, acrid smoke, as if the exhaust from a diesel bus were being piped directly into the room. Twice during the night, coughing uncontrollably, I had to flee outside for air. By morning, my eyes were burning and bloodshot, my nostrils were clogged with black soot, and I developed a dry, persistent hack that would stay with me until the end of the expedition. Rob had intended for us to stay just one day acclimatizing in Lobije before traveling the final 6 or 7 miles to base camp, which our Sherpas had reached some days earlier in order to ready the site for our arrival and begin establishing a route up the lower slopes of Everest itself. On the evening of April 7th, however, a breathless runner arrived in Lobije with a disturbing message from base camp. Tenzing, a young Sherpa employed by Rob, had fallen 150 feet into a crevasse, a gaping crack in the glacier. 4 other Sherpas had hauled him out alive, but he was seriously injured, possibly with a broken femur. Rob, ashen-faced, announced that he and Mike Groom would hurry to base camp at dawn to coordinate Tenzing's rescue. "I regret to have to tell you this," he continued, "but the rest of you will need to wait here in Lobaje with Harold until we get the situation under control." Tenzing, we later learned, had been scouting the route above Camp 1, climbing a relatively gentle section of the Khumbu Glacier with four other Sherpas. The five men were walking single file, which was smart, but they weren't using a rope, a serious violation of mountaineering protocol. Tenzing was moving closely behind the other four, stepping exactly where they had stepped, when he broke through a thin veneer of snow spanning a deep crevasse. Before he even had time to yell, he dropped like a rock into the Sumerian bowels of the glacier. At 20,500 feet, the altitude was deemed too high for safe evacuation by helicopter. The air was too insubstantial to provide much lift for a helicopter's rotors, making landing, taking off, or merely hovering unreasonably hazardous, so he would have to be carried 3,000 vertical feet to base camp down the Khumbu Icefall, some of the steepest, most treacherous ground on the entire mountain. Getting Tenzing down alive would require a massive effort. Rob was always especially concerned about the welfare of the Sherpas who worked for him. Before our group departed Kathmandu, he had sat all of us down and given us an uncommonly stern lecture about the need to show our Sherpa staff gratitude and proper respect. "The Sherpas we've hired are the best in the business," he told us. "They work incredibly hard for not very much money by Western standards. I want you all to remember, we would have absolutely no chance of getting to the summit of Everest without their help. I'm going to repeat that. Without the support of our Sherpas, none of us has any chance of climbing the mountain." In a subsequent conversation, Rob confessed that in past years he'd been critical of some expedition leaders for being careless with their Sherpa staff. In 1995, a young Sherpa had died on Everest. Hall speculated that the accident may have occurred because the Sherpa had been allowed to climb high on the mountain without proper training. "I believe that it's the responsibility of those of us who run these trips to prevent that sort of thing from happening." The previous year, a guided American expedition had hired a Sherpa named Kami Rita as a cook boy. Strong and ambitious, 21 or 22 years old, he lobbied hard to be allowed to work on the upper mountain as a climbing Sherpa. In appreciation for Kami's enthusiasm and dedication, some weeks later, his wish was granted, despite the fact that he had no climbing experience and had received no formal training in proper techniques. From 22,000 feet to 25,000 feet, the standard route ascends a sheer, treacherous ice slope known as the Lhotse Face. As a safety measure, expeditions always attach a series of ropes to this slope from bottom to top, and climbers are supposed to protect themselves by clipping a short safety tether to the fixed ropes as they ascend. Kami, being young and cocky and inexperienced, didn't think it was really necessary to clip into the rope. One afternoon, as he was carrying a load up the Lhotse Face, he lost his purchase on the rock-hard ice and fell more than 2,000 feet to the bottom of the wall. My teammate Frank Fishbeck had witnessed the whole episode. In 1995, he was making his third attempt on Everest as a client of the American company that had hired Kami. "Frank was ascending the ropes on the upper Lhotse Face," he said in a troubled voice, "when I looked up and saw a person tumbling down from above, falling head over heels. He was screaming as he went past and left a trail of blood." Some climbers rushed to where Kami came to rest at the bottom of the face, but he had died from the extensive injuries he'd suffered on the way down. His body was brought down to base camp, where in the Buddhist tradition, his friends brought meals to feed the corpse for 3 days. Then he was carried to a village near Tengboche and cremated. As the body was consumed by flames, Kami's mother wailed inconsolably and struck her head with a sharp rock. Kami was very much in Rob's mind at first light on April 8th, when he and Mike hurried toward base camp to try and get Tenzing off Everest alive. Chapter 5. Lobaje, April 8, 1996. 16,200 feet. Passing through the towering ice pinnacles of Phantom Alley, we entered the rock-strewn valley floor at the bottom of a huge amphitheater. Here, the icefall turned sharply to flow southward, as the Khumbu Glacier. We set up our base camp at 17,800 feet on the lateral moraine that formed the outer edge of the turn. Huge boulders lent an air of solidity to the place, but the rolling rubble underfoot corrected the misimpression. All that one could see and feel and hear of icefall, moraine, avalanche, cold, was of a world not intended for human habitation. No water flowed, nothing grew, only destruction and decay. This would be home for the next several months, until the mountain was climbed. Thomas F. Hornbein, Everest, the West Ridge. On April 8th, just after dark, Andy's handheld radio crackled to life outside the lodge in Lobje. It was Rob, calling from base camp, and he had good news. It had taken a team of 35 Sherpas from several different expeditions the entire day, but they'd gotten Tenzing down. Strapping him to an aluminum ladder, they managed to lower, drag, and carry him through the icefall, and he was now resting from the ordeal at base camp. If the weather held, a helicopter would arrive at sunrise to fly him to a hospital in Kathmandu. With audible relief, Rob gave us the go-ahead to leave Lobje in the morning and proceed to base camp ourselves. We clients were also immensely relieved that Tenzing was safe, and we were no less relieved to be getting out of Lobje. John and Lou had picked up some kind of virulent intestinal ailment from the unclean surroundings. Helen, our base camp manager, had a grinding altitude-induced headache that wouldn't go away, and my cough had worsened considerably after a second night in the smoke-filled lodge. For this, our third night in the village, I decided to escape the noxious smudge by moving into a tent, pitched just outside, that Rob and Mike had vacated when they went to base camp. Andy elected to move in with me. At 2 a.m., I was awakened when he bolted into a sitting position beside me and began to moan. "Yo, Harold," I inquired from my sleeping bag. "Are you okay?" "I'm not sure, actually. Something I ate for dinner doesn't seem to be sitting too well just now." A moment later, Andy desperately pawed the zippered door open and barely managed to thrust his head and torso outside before vomiting. After the retching subsided, he hunkered motionless on his hands and knees for several minutes, half out of the tent. Then he sprang to his feet, sprinted a few meters away, yanked his trousers down, and succumbed to a loud attack of diarrhea. He spent the rest of the night out in the cold, violently discharging the contents of his gastrointestinal tract. In the morning, Andy was weak, dehydrated, and shivering violently. Helen suggested he remain in Lobje until he regained some strength, but Andy refused to consider it. "There's no way in bloody hell I'm spending another night in this shithole," he announced, grimacing, with his head between his knees. "I'm going on to base camp today with the rest of you, even if I have to bloody crawl." By 9 a.m., we'd packed up and gotten underway. While the rest of the group moved briskly up the trail, Helen and I stayed behind to walk with Andy, who had to exert a monumental effort just to put one foot in front of the other. Again and again he would stop, hunch over his ski poles to collect himself for several minutes, then summon the energy to struggle onward. The route climbed up and down the unsettled rocks of the Khumbu Glacier's lateral moraine for several miles, then dropped down onto the glacier itself. Cinders, coarse gravel, and granite boulders covered much of the ice, but every now and then the trail would cross a patch of bare glacier, a translucent, frozen medium that glistened like polished onyx. Meltwater sluiced furiously down innumerable surface and subterranean channels, creating a ghostly harmonic rumble that resonated through the body of the glacier. In mid-afternoon we reached a bizarre procession of freestanding ice pinnacles, the largest nearly 100 feet high, known as Phantom Alley. Sculpted by the intense solar rays, glowing a radioactive shade of turquoise, the towers reared like giant shark's teeth out of the surrounding rubble as far as the eye could see. Helen, who'd been over this ground numerous times, announced that we were getting close to our destination. A couple of miles farther, the glacier made a sharp turn to the east. We plodded to the crest of a long slope, and spread out before us was a motley city of nylon domes. More than 300 tents, housing as many climbers and Sherpas from 14 expeditions, speckled the boulder-strewn ice. It took us 20 minutes to locate our compound among the sprawling settlement. As we climbed the final rise, Rob strode down to greet us. "Welcome to Everest Base Camp," he grinned. The altimeter on my wristwatch read 17,600 feet. The ad hoc village that would serve as our home for the next 6 weeks sat at the head of a natural amphitheater delineated by forbidding mountain walls. The escarpments above camp were draped with hanging glaciers, from which calved immense ice avalanches that thundered down at all hours of the day and night. A quarter mile to the east, pinched between the Nupsi Wall and the west shoulder of Everest, the Khumbu Icefall spilled through a narrow gap in a chaos of frozen shards. The amphitheater opened to the southwest, so it was flooded with sunlight. On clear afternoons when there was no wind, it was warm enough to sit comfortably outside in a t-shirt. But the moment the sun dipped behind the conical summit of Pamori, a 23,507-foot peak immediately west of base camp, the temperature plummeted into the teens. Retiring to my tent at night, I was serenaded by a madrigal of creaks and percussive cracks, a reminder that I was lying on a moving river of ice. In striking contrast to the harshness of our surroundings stood the myriad creature comforts of the Adventure Consultants' Camp, home to 14 Westerners. The Sherpas referred to us collectively as members, or sahibs, and 14 Sherpas. Our mess tent, a cavernous canvas structure, was furnished with an enormous stone table, a stereo system, a library, and solar-powered electric lights. An adjacent communications tent housed a satellite phone and fax. A shower had been improvised from a rubber hose and a bucket filled with water heated by the kitchen staff. Fresh bread and vegetables arrived every few days on the backs of yaks. Continuing a Raj-era tradition established by expeditions of yore, every morning Chongba and his cookboy, Tendi, came to each client's tent to serve us steaming mugs of Sherpa tea in our sleeping bags. I had heard many stories about how Everest had been turned into a garbage dump by the ever-increasing hordes, and commercial expeditions were reputed to be the primary culprits. Although in the 1970s and 80s, base camp was indeed a big rubbish heap, in recent years it had been turned into a fairly tidy place, certainly the cleanest human settlement I'd seen since leaving Namche Bazaar. And the commercial expeditions actually deserved much of the credit for the cleanup. Bringing clients back to Everest year after year, the guides had a stake in this that one-time visitors did not. As part of their expedition in 1990, Rob Hall and Gary Ball spearheaded an effort that removed 5 tons of garbage from base camp. Hall and some of his fellow guides also began working with government ministries in Kathmandu to formulate policies that encouraged climbers to keep the mountain clean. By 1996, in addition to their permit fee, expeditions were required to post a $4,000 bond that would be refunded only if a predetermined amount of trash were carried back to Namche and Kathmandu. Even the barrels collecting the excrement from our toilets had to be removed and hauled away. Base camp bustled like an anthill. In a certain sense, Hall's Adventure Consultants' compound served as the seat of government for the entire base camp, because nobody on the mountain commanded more respect than Hall. Whenever there was a problem, a labor dispute with the Sherpas, a medical emergency, a critical decision about climbing strategy, people trudged over to our mess tent to seek Hall's advice. And he generously dispensed his accumulated wisdom to the very rivals who were competing with him for clients, most notably Scott Fisher. Previously, Fisher had successfully guided one 8,000-meter mountain, 26,400-foot broad peak in the Karakoram range of Pakistan in 1995. Note, there are 14 so-called 8,000-meter peaks, mountains that stand more than 8,000 meters, 26,246 feet, above sea level. Although it is a somewhat arbitrary designation, mountaineers have always attached special prestige to ascents of 8,000-meter peaks. The first person to climb all 14 of them was Reinhold Messner in 1986. To date, only 4 other climbers have repeated the feat. End of note. He'd also attempted Everest 4 times and reached the top once in 1994, but not in the role of a guide. The spring of 1996 marked his first visit to the mountain as the leader of a commercial expedition. Like Hall, Fisher had 8 clients in his group.